If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
It's time for a completely unnecessary podcast for, wow, Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015, alongside irritable Ian Ferguson. I'm Pat Contry. We have a soiree of topics tonight. It's going to be
a party of topics?
A cornucopia.
A cornucopia.
A collection. Of conversations about the latest in modern gaming, retro gaming news, movies. Talk about a little bit of movie stuff, pop culture, and your Q&A on the show tonight. We're talking about Splatoon. Just came out, and Ian's review of that, as well as a UK Splatoon shipment being stolen, like a huge chunk of them, actually.
That was Amiibos.
And we're talking about Vita now officially being a legacy console. H1Z1 band players that can apologize publicly to get back in. The Intellivision Kickstarter for three remastered games. A new Mega Man animated series announced. The Rock being cast in Big Trouble in Little China remake? What? The Kung Fury viral short-ish film. Tron 3 being canceled. And an experiment about driving up retro game prices that was reported to me. The humble Nindy bundle. And your Q&A. Ian, how are you doing? How's your tummy?
Not great. not great at all. It's an adventure every day. Really?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, I'm in the middle of keeping a food diary.
Is that like a Deal-A-Meal sort of thing with Richard Simmons?
No. I write down everything that I put into my system so that I can take it back to the doctor and they can evaluate it and we can go from there. And they're going to see if I have any sensitivities to things that are suddenly popping up because, you know, 32 years old is when you enter your twilight years and all these things start happening to you. So,
well, you don't look a day... Day over 53. Nope. So
it's just like Louis C.K. said, at 40 or so, doctors stop fixing things. They just report to you what's broken.
Yeah, this shit doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, that doesn't work. No. Yeah, so no. I'm afraid that that's what's happening to my digestive system.
And soon to follow the endocrine system and all the nice other circulatory and I'm running out of systems.
As long as my PC engine system does not fail, I am fine.
Oh, wow. So what have I been doing? Well, I'm supposed to be writing a new NES Punk episode. It's been a slow time coming because I put out a Flea Market Madness last week. And I had a visitor here spending time here for like 5 days, which you should hear about. It should be pretty cool when it's announced. And that'll be later, hopefully in June. And then I'm working on my writing project that I might announce soon. That'll be cool. Ian's so excited for the writing project.
I'm trying to look forward. Looking engaged.
Okay. You're not showing your teeth as much as before, but okay, you're still engaged. And then, other than that, though, I might be at E3 at least for a day or two. That could be fun. Hmm. Doing what? I don't know, but I might be at E3.
The E3 thing has never appealed to me. Every year, it's like, do you want to go? And we just send our employees instead. I mean, is it fun? You've done it before. Is it a good time?
It's fun when someone doesn't stab you in the back and make up lies about you. But other than that, it's
not exactly it's where I was going.
But no, it's fun to talk to. It's actually fun. The press conferences are fun.
Okay.
So I've been to, I was at the initial one in 2011 when they first announced the Wii U, when they were so confused and people were confused, like, is this an add-on or a new system? Like, that's how far back. That was the first one I went to, 11, 12, and 13. So I've been to a few conferences. Usually Nintendo's are really fun. They do a fun one. I think I went to another one. Like, it was either a Sony or Microsoft one, but I was like, I probably fell asleep during it.
Right.
I think I might have been to a Sony one in 2011 or 12. But no, I like walking around the floor. I like the for retro game stuff. I mean, it used to be that you'd see, 3 years ago, you'd have Konami with all their retro game stuff, and Namco booth would have stuff, and then a Sega booth, and then you'd have Atari putting out their new Warlords or Centipede Infestation game, and now they're not there anymore. Like, those games are no longer exist as so there's less retro game stuff for me to even look for.
When I used to read about the E3s in like the late 90s, and you know, growing up and whatnot. One of my favorite things was in, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, like a Sean Baby, but not just him. Other people would talk about the
those back, the back
the abandoned halls and the back alleys with like the weird bullshit. Do those still exist?
No, not to the same extent for a couple of reasons. I think the space is a lot more money, and I think it's a lot more competitive, the market. So there's no like sort of wayward places. I mean, if you go to the edges of conventions, whether it's PAX East, you'll have like it's less money to be on the edge in the smaller booths, but it's less of a jokey thing like Sean Baby would report on in like the mid to late 90s. I think it's a little more professional. Now, if you go to CES, that's a whole other story, because CES is a field day of that stuff, because you have companies literally coming from all over the Asian market. A lot of them have either interpreters or can't speak English. We're talking like they have all this shit, all this toys, and they do have like, at least when I went to CES 5 years ago, they had a whole like extra building room just for like the lower caliber people.
See, that would entice me to go to
like,
something
like
that.
Like people selling the rollout piano USB devices, you know, like, oh, then they come up to you, oh, you want 10,000 of these, 20,000? It's like, whoa, I'm just looking. Like, they're looking for buyers.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like, this is how they're making their money for the year, you know, but that doesn't exist anymore at E3, at least.
Let's talk about
Splatoon.
So, Splatoon's exciting for a number of reasons, mostly because Nintendo, for the first time in I don't even fucking know how long, it has a new IP, a new creative property.
10 years.
Yeah, and I mean, they really took a risk on this one, too, because the look is decidedly outside of Nintendo's normal look. Nintendo is always fun-looking, but this has... I've been having a lot of fun trying to describe the aesthetic. I think on Twitter I described it as American late 90s Extreme Cheetos Future Japan. Like, I mean, it's got a little bit of Jet Set Radio, a little bit of Designers Republic, and a whole lot of like 1990s Nickelodeon in it. And it looks unlike anything Nintendo's done.
Third-person shooter.
Yeah, so it's a third-person shooter, and while it does have a single-player mode... it has been advertised as and is largely a multiplayer game, which is also new for Nintendo. I mean, they're stepping into two different pools of strange water there. There's the fact that they've never really done a shooter like this before, and then there's the fact that there's all these games that are coming out these days, let's say like Titanfall or something like that, that entirely rely on like being online. And while Nintendo did put a first-person or a first a single-player campaign in here, the fact that it is mostly online is risky for them.
Sure.
So, I mean, to basically review it, to talk about the time I've spent, and I did spend quite a bit of time with it over the weekend, it's fantastic. It's not without some minor problems, and I'll touch on those.
Well, let's talk about like what is this game?
So, it's there's not a whole lot about what. So you are a squid person, and these squid people like to have fights with ink. It's not malicious. They're not fighting a war. They just run around and shoot paint everywhere. So you get two teams of four, and you can pick from three basic subclasses of weapons. Rollers, guns, which are called splatter shots, and the sniper rifles, which are called chargers. And each one leaves paint behind when you shoot. The rollers don't shoot, they just roll. So they cover large portions, but they leave you vulnerable and open and slow. The splatter shots are kind of your middle ground. And then you have your snipers who can't do much coverage because their shot is very narrow. But strategically, they're useful for choke points.
Well, what's the goal?
To cover as much of the ground in your own color of paint as possible.
And there was like 3 minutes you get about?
You get 3 minutes. And it's insanely frantic. It's like Choo Choo Rocket levels of frantic. So the interesting mechanic beyond just the fact that you're playing a game where you're just supposed to cover everything in paint is the fact that your squid kid can turn into a squid. And when you're a squid, you can swim through your own paint. What this does is it increases your movement speed. It hides you. It doesn't protect you, but it hides you when you're moving. It makes you harder to see. And you can use it to climb up walls, to hit ramps, to jump. Yeah, to get higher jumps from one area to another. So it's really important immediately to learn how to swim in the ink and when you should. It also is the only way you can refill your weapon. So does it work? Yeah, it works incredibly well. It works so well that when you're losing, you're still having fun. the lack of voice chat does not affect my enjoyment of it in any way, shape, or form, and I'll give you two reasons why, and one is going to go back into touching on the game. One, I always fear going online in games that require me to talk to strangers because I don't like to fucking do it. It's not even so much the shit talkers, it's just the fact that I don't like to deal with a bunch of people I don't know when I'm trying to play something team-based. The other reason why you don't need it is because of the integral nature of the gamepad, and this is something I like. Because a lot of the Wii U games that have come out haven't really needed it. And that's okay. That means that if Vonnie wants to watch Doctor Who or something, I can pick up the gamepad and play Mario Kart 8. No problem. But on the gamepad, when you're playing Splatoon, you get a map that shows you how much of the map you've covered in your paint from an overhead view and how much of the map has been covered by the opponent's paint. But an important thing that you can do in the game is called rocket jumping, and you're not limited to how many of these you can do. On the map, it will show where your other teammates are. And by pressing one of their buttons with their name and their face on it, you will immediately, not immediately, there's a warm-up period to it, but you'll rocket off and fly across the screen as a squid and land next to your teammate to provide backup, or if you've got everything covered down here, but he's made progress into enemy territory, you can jump to him and cover the paint. And that's important, too, because enemy paint will poison you. So if you get hit by it, you're dead. So you got to make sure that if someone's trying to cover something, that someone with a wider range can also cover the outer areas so that you can run and escape from it.
Okay, so it's obviously team-based. There's one main game mode. And I do think Nintendo is going to be releasing more, though, more types of game modes, which is, unfortunately, that's the world we're living in now, where it's not just because, well, at least they're not going to be charging for it, but I think it's to keep interest where 6-7 months from now, you're still going to have these different modes and events coming out. Because I saw how there's going to be like timed weekend events for like special competitions and things like that. That's a really cool idea to get people playing the game at certain times.
You're going to get those, but they're doing new gear and weapon updates. They're doing map updates, at least until August. August is when they put up team building and they add two new game modes. Until then, they're adding weapons. Like, they added the Nintendo Zapper. It's called the Splat Zap 85, and it is literally a Nintendo Zapper. Another big thing about the game is clothing, and with which they add clothing, is, like, basically armor. So you dress up your squid however you want, but it gives you stat boosts, like increased range, decreased ink usage, etc. So the main reason I think Nintendo is doing this is, and I'm happy they're not charging for it, is I look at it this way. With modern games, we have people who are putting out games at 60 and then charging 30 on top for additional content. Nintendo's putting out a game at 60, and they're rolling out content slowly. This keeps people holding on to the game that they enjoy. This keeps people from selling back the game. This keeps word of mouth going around, hey, they just added all this stuff. People get more interested. People go out and buy new copies of the game because there aren't as many used copies on the shelf. Nintendo is finding, I think, if I had to guess, this is Nintendo finding an interesting way to make more money off of new game sales and not piss off the consumers with things like immediately necessary $30 season passes.
Or having the exclusive GameStop version where you get ink armor that's not available at first or whatever. So they're doing it in a smart way. My only objection to any first-person or any, like, this isn't first-person, any shooter game is that having it too imbalanced, where a person just getting in the game will get destroyed by someone that's leveled up so much already and won't have a chance. Because most good shooters don't do that, and it relies more on, okay, equal skill, equal weapons, equal armament options. That's my only sort of, okay, that's kind of unique for a shooter, a competitive shooter, to venture into that realm where you can level up to that extent and get different weapons that other players can't get. That's the only thing that kind of bothers me. I hope they really keep the balancing of the weapons. It sounds like there's a lot of different type of weapons here.
There is.
So the weapon balance is key. Even for a game where the main objective is not to kill the other player, it's still key, obviously, in controlling what comes down to, like, a turf war. That's what they call it, right?
Let me put it this way. If you're worried about the balance, some of the weapons that I've unlocked at higher levels have proven to not be quite so useful in Turf War. They might be more useful in Splat Zones, which is a territory control. Meanwhile, there are a lot of people who are at level 12, 13, and I think the cap currently is at 20, who are still using the first gun because it's balanced enough to
do whatever
still be used.
Sure.
Just like the Splat Zap wasn't, I don't believe, wasn't walled off to any level. Anyone who started playing could go and buy it, and tons of people are using it now because it's fun and it gets the job done. So I don't think there's a huge issue with that. People initially were concerned that the rollers were going to be overpowered, but I gotta tell you, after a day of playing, I can sit there and pick off rollers, and it's not an issue.
Okay, so for those people that complain about Nintendo not having a new IP, here you go. I mean, and plus it's in a genre they've never tackled before, with the exception of Metroid Prime. You can say if you can call those shooters, shooters on semi-rails, you know.
They're more adventure games than anything, yeah. But... I guess in closing, I just say, I mean, it's fun. It looks great. It sounds great. It's fun to play. It's going to be...
You have a cat, Judge.
You have a cat. Yeah, Judd. Judd is amazing. Judd's his name, and he sleeps on top of a mailbox when you're not playing. But yeah, Judd's fantastic. When the game ends, when the match ends, you have a rough idea of how well you did, but it creeps the bars up. Uh-huh. And to like even levels, like 26.2 and 26.2, and it hangs for a second, and then it crushes one way or another, and it's just, I mean, the tension is fun.
You like the whole interface of having like the city to go into, the Squid Sisters to announce stuff? Do you like that? Is it fun?
Yeah, I like it. I don't find that annoying. I like all the puns. I like all the forced like 90s slang. All of that to me.
It's in a different language, though, right?
I mean, yeah. They sound like Animal Crossing characters. Okay. But it's, to me, like, when I read that stuff, it just goes with the aesthetic. The only other thing I would touch on is this. I have seen people concerned. So my review of the game is definitely a thumbs up. But there are people who seem concerned about Nintendo's ability to maintain a player base. Which, okay, if you look at some games like Evolve or Titanfall, where player bases fall off, or you go back to like the Xbox 360, every game had an online mode, you know, something like Fear or whatever. But, you know, you'd lose players within a month. I think people who are fearing that Nintendo's not going to be able to retain this player base forget that this is on the Wii U. The system is kind of, I don't want to say clicky or cultish, but it's its own little circle. Mm-hmm. And while there are definitely enough good games on the system to warrant buying it, it's not like there's something new coming out every week. You're not going to see another Splatoon on the system, just like you're not really going to see another Mario Kart or another Smash. I think that these are games that are probably going to be played for a good chunk of the Wii U's lifespan, simply because of the nature of how the Nintendo systems work, and, you know, their own IPs tend to stick out more than anything. You don't have a lot, I guess, for better or worse, you don't have a lot of other options.
Real quick about the UK shipment of, what was it, the Amiibo packs, Splatoon, that were basically the entire stock was stolen for, what's the main game store in the UK?
I don't remember.
But it was basically, we'll just say, the vast majority of the UK supply was stolen, which is obviously really shitty, on one truck.
It's awful. And it just goes to show you how fucking ridiculous this Amiibo shit has gotten when people are heisting
I don't,
trucks.
Okay, hold
Amiibos.
On there. I don't think this was a GTA thing where they knew what it was.
Let me think what I want in my head. Yeah. This was
I don't
a
think
heist.
It said Nintendo Splatoon on the side. I think they just got a random truck, or could have been an inside job where the driver knew someone.
It was a pack of like five motorcycles with walkie-talkies.
Oh,
they
all
knew it was Amiibos.
And Vin Diesel's around in the car.
Yeah, there was grappling hooks. Yeah. That's how it went down.
Michelle Rodriguez shows up and jumps off the car in every single freaking movie.
Yeah.
It's bad. I don't know how they're going to unload all those. You're talking probably like 20,000 or whatever.
If the majority 10,000. Of the shipment, how are you going to unload hot Amiibos? What are you going to do? Ship them back to the U.S.?
You're
going to
do a Dutch auction on eBay with like 5,000? Buy it now? You know, what are you going
to
do?
I do feel bad, though, to a degree, because honestly, these Amiibos... I actually have some coming. Our pal Norm is actually helped me out with that. These Amiibos do more for the game than almost any other Amiibo. They let you unlock gear through each Amiibo has 20 additional missions, and that unlocks, so that would be 60 total missions for the three Amiibos, and you unlock new gear that you can't get in the game. So it actually gives you something instead of just a costume.
They got to open it out of the package.
Yeah, I'm gonna slice mine open as soon as I get it.
This was interesting. This happened. This is old news. For people that complain this is old news, if you don't realize, we actually don't record every day and wear the same stuff. We record
people
every other week.
People seem to think that. It's hilarious. People seem to think that I have a large bottle of beer every segment.
Well, every day, but I don't think I could have it eaten over every day. Anyway, so what happened was, this happened basically the day of the last podcast. And we've talked about H1Z1 before, I think, way in the past. You know, one of these zombie survival games.
There's so many.
Is it a zombie survival or is it just a survival game?
No, it's a zombie survival.
It's a zombie survival. So I guess there's more and more rampant cheating happening in the community with all these mods that are available. So I love this guy. His name's John Smedley. And I guess he's in charge of H1Z1. And so he just basically tweeted, why do these dumbasses keep using TM Cheats? Which I guess is the downloadable mod. Have you people not figured out we ban you all? So they did like a blanket ban of all these players. And this is a paid game subscription you got to pay.
Yeah.
So I guess people were tired of, getting in the game and using these mods. So I don't know much about this game. All I do know is that this guy did an awesome sort of fuck you to these cheaters and said, if you want us to even consider your apology, a public YouTube apology is necessary in order to be unbanned.
Well,
no personal information. Please email me the link.
So it's interesting because...
Shame them.
I'm not even sure it's a subscription. It could be. I think it might have been free to play. But you obviously have to dump money into it. And what people were getting pissed about, I think, was the people who wanted to play it legitimately getting bulldozed by the people who aren't playing it legitimately. So he puts that out there. And there are some... So they start rolling in. And some of them don't seem very genuine. Like just because he said make a YouTube apology... doesn't mean that if you make one, you're going to get reinstated. As a matter of fact, they've only reinstated 3 accounts.
From what I saw, it said 3 out of... They banned 30,000 people?
They've reinstated 3 accounts, and they said that by the end of it, he does not expect to reinstate more than 4 or 5 total.
Wow.
And these people were like... It's funny, because I can't watch these videos. Luckily, some of them have transcripts underneath them. And they're all like these kind of like couched apologies with like, well, this is why I did it, but I'm sorry.
Beating on me. I was tired of getting picked on when I get in the game.
And, I spent a lot of money on this, but, I guess I'm sorry for cheating. Yeah, I mean, it was just whatever.
The update was he did ban 5 out of 30,000. That was like 14 days ago.
He had reinstated 5
out of 30,000. I just think it's funny as hell.
I do, too, because, like, look, if you do this and you want to say some shit, fine, but... have you ever played a game online and you suck at it and you're trying to get good, or any game and you're trying to get good, and then you find out that your opposition is cheating on top of you trying to get better? Fuck that.
I'm glad they did this, because the only real competitive gaming, I was semi-competitive when I played Unreal Tournament 2004. There were lots of hacks going on, and the developer didn't give a shit. Like, there wasn't, like, any blanket bans that I knew of. It was all police within the community. If you saw someone using, I think it was called, like, the hit scan, mm-hmm. where, like, as soon as the cursor goes over the guy, it'll fire automatically.
Right.
Or being able to see through walls to see where a person was. That's hard to prove that unless you have the developer helping out and giving tools to people to help out.
Right.
Otherwise, they don't care. The game's been out for like 3 years. We don't care. We made our money. It's not worth our time to police this. So I'm glad that they're taking a positive sort of step here, especially if you said if it's not subscription-based, people are paying into this to enjoy this game.
Yeah, I could be wrong about
that. I don't like these survival games either way. I've watched gameplay footage of this stuff. This goes back to the ones we've covered where
that's the thing. I don't even remember which one we've covered, because there's like 15 of these things now.
There's ones where you start off and you're like naked with no clothes, and you have to... Beat someone over the head with a rock to get their stuff, and it's just like, it's just not for me. But no, I'm glad. Shame the cheaters. And I don't like to judge people too much when it comes to this, but I will. What is in your character that you have to cheat at a video game, like, to this extent, and then ruin the experience for other people? Like, I just don't understand that mentality. Like, what?
It's like the Call of Duty players or Battlefield players who buy the modified controllers. Whose dick? What is the point of this? Are you puffing up your own penis?
It's like they fire a teeny bit faster with the handgun or something?
It lets, like, the slow-fire weapons become, like, rapid-fire and stuff. So, like, your really, really strong, like, one- or two-shot, rifles or whatever turn into, like, machine guns, basically. It's just... It's stupid. It's dumb. You know what else is stupid? Stupidity, apparently, these days, is going up against Nintendo in the handheld market. The Sony said in a investors conference last week that the Vita is now a legacy console, along with the PlayStation TV, also known as the Vita TV.
We talked about that in the first podcast, I think.
What?
The Vita TV.
It's
been less than 2 years.
It only hit here. We talked about it, but it hasn't hit here. It didn't hit here until 5-6 months ago.
Oh wow! Okay.
So it hasn't even been here that long. So it's a legacy console, and that's a nice way of saying
obsolete.
We're done supporting it. Now, obviously, that does not mean that there are no more games coming out for it. It means Sony's done investing in it. They're done putting money into games. They did, you know, they have been good to indie developers, apparently, about getting out, like, free dev kits or cheap dev kits so they can make games for it. And there are obviously going to be a lot of companies in Japan that are still going to make, you know, niche RPGs and stuff like that. And those will see releases over here, you know, some of them. So it's not like it's going, you know, from this point on, you're never going to see another Vita game again. But it's, man, Sony threw in the towel fast on that one. I mean, I know we're talking probably 2 or 3 years, but that's quick. And the PSP, you know, did okay for them, but wasn't great. What was even more humorous for the legacy console comment is that a lower Sony rep, a PR rep, came out and said that what Mr. House, Andrew House, said about the Sony being a legacy console was actually referring to the old 1000 model of the system. And writing off those components.
The one that's 10 years old?
No. The original Vita 1000, which would be like the first model that came out like 3 years ago.
I'm thinking original PSP.
No. Oh. He's talking about the original one, except the fact that that hasn't been in manufacture for like a year, and that's not what he's talking about. And the representative was like, it doesn't mean the current PS Vita or PSTV models, but it's just... You can try to save face all you want. The Vita's done. It never got a foothold here. That's in Sony. Sony is not going to lie to their investors. Here's the thing. The Sony spokesperson is trying to do a public face saving, but what Andrew House did was tell the investors, please don't worry about this monkey on our back anymore. It's in the past. We are no longer going to throw money that is wasted at this. He has to say that to... bring their confidence back up in Sony. They're not going to continue to support something that's going to cause them to lose investor money. Sony needs all the money they can get now.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the company's in great shape to begin with. So they're probably like, oh, well, you have this handheld wing over here that's making us jack shit.
Yeah.
You know, the PS4 is not profitable probably still, so it's like, well... Get rid of this at least. Well, but the PS4, they have a shot to be profitable with that eventually, but not for the handheld market.
The PS4 is selling, and that was their last ditch effort, was to try to position the Vita as a PS4 peripheral. And still no one's buying it. I mean, no one cares. And I think it's, you know, it's partially indicative of handhelds in general, but really... It's indicative of the fact that Nintendo did it first, and that I think when people look for portables, they're always going to look for Nintendo. There are going to be some Sony super fans who are going to bemoan me saying that, but let's look at all the other systems that have tried to go up against Nintendo handhelds. The Game Gear, the Lynx, the Neo Geo Pocket Color, the Wonder Swan, the PSP, all systems that
GameCom,
all systems that did not... even come close to putting a dent into the Nintendo sales, even if they were good systems.
Well, the Game Gear did well. Game Gear did fairly well.
Well, the PS in the first PSP, admittedly, did do fairly well, too.
But still, it's not even close. So no. You know that. It's not close.
They did enough to not be failures. They just didn't do enough.
It's all, it's all about the software for the handhelds, or software in any system. But Nintendo handhelds always had the software.
When we talk at... When handheld chat comes up at work, it basically boils down to... The Vita's a real slick piece of hardware. It's really nice. The 3DS has the games.
It's like the Betamax, better than VHS, but doesn't matter. There's nothing to play on it.
Sure, the Vita, the modern day Betamax, which portable
is now,
gaming,
which is now becoming Blu-ray because no one has Blu-ray. So this is interesting. This came up. We talked about Kickstarter for. Remember, it was like a year and a half ago about the ColecoVision one about. I think it was like to get 20 ColecoVision games as on an app, and that didn't do well. This one's not doing well either, and this is for Intellivision. This is for the Intellivision. It's called Gen 2 Video Games. This is by a company called, I think it's a Retro Action.
Yeah, it is Retro Action Entertainment,
and they're working closely with Keith Robinson, president of Intellivision Productions, and Dave Warhol. Former original television game designer and owner of development studios, Real Time Associates. Okay, so what they're doing here is They want to do a Kickstarter. The goal is $100,000 to get three of the more popular games, one of which we cover on Video Game Years. Astro Smash, which eventually became the Pac-Man game.
Yep.
Shark Shark and Night Stalker.
All three are actually quite fun. I'm not going to deny
probably
that.
In the upper echelon of Intellivision
yeah.
games.
Astro Smash is fantastic, in fact.
Astro Smash is sort of like, I guess...
Asteroids meet Space Invaders, and you
go back and forth, and you shoot, and they break up, and you have to avoid the broken up asteroids coming down.
And again. The thing I always liked is you lose points for every asteroid that you let hit the ground. So there's a... There's an incentive to keep things frantic and to constantly dive around the screen.
Shark Shark, you have to avoid the sharks.
It's the classic eat small fish until you become bigger, eat less small fish. And with each fish that you eat, you get bigger and bigger, basically.
And then I'm not too familiar with Night Stalker, but you said that's a maze game, single screen.
It's a maze game that is similar to like Pac-Man meets Berserk, sort of. You can get a gun and then you have to shoot the robots and get out, but it's narrow like Pac-Man.
So the goal was $100,000, and they're not going to, I guess, do this project unless it gets funded, which is a shame for a couple of reasons, because obviously there's 140 backers only, and that's not a lot of support for this. But obviously there's Intellivision fans. But what's strange to me is that at least two of these games have full trailer, like minutes of gameplay footage. So these are developed. Like
6 minutes and 29 seconds of a revamped version of Astro Smash to me says that that game is basically ready to go out the door.
And there's also gameplay footage of Shark Shark.
Yes.
Night Stalker, I didn't find it, though.
No.
But so at least for two out of these three games, they seem ready to go. These aren't the most most complicated games.
No.
So it's a fresh coated paint.
You're reskinning them and you're adding a couple new power-ups, which to me doesn't really need to be done, but okay.
So if there's not a market for it, that's fine. But I'm just trying to wrap my head around...
$100,000? Yes, that's what I'm trying to wrap my head
around.
It's
sort of strange because, again, it's not like... If these weren't developed at all from scratch, okay, I can see them needing the money to put into that. And I would assume that they already got the rights to do these, otherwise why go through the development cycles to get to that point for these new versions? There's not much more I can really say about it. It's probably will not get funded.
Well,
so for those... a few dozen fans of Intellivision games out there that want a remake. I mean, I guess play the originals that are out there.
There is this, which to me is kind of weird. We've had some questions regarding our use of funds. Here's a breakdown detailing where the money will be going, because I question why you need $100,000 to put out three games, two of which look almost finished. And 50% of it, just a solid 50% chunk of the pie chart, says game development. And
just off, okay, so $50,000 for game development.
If you scroll down into the bottom of the Kickstarter, how is that? I mean, okay,
10% for licensing. Again, I would assume they got licensing though if they're already developing it.
Yep, me too.
Rewards and fulfillment, that's fine. You have fees, that's fine. I'm not going to question that. Legal and taxes, 11%. Okay, there's taxes. Business expense, IT, customer service, etc.
I don't question the small pieces of the pie. I question the big piece of the pie because, look, you have almost no backers right now and no money. A lot of the money is coming from, if I recall correctly, higher tier backers. So it's just a few people who are interested so far in this, and some of them are paying more. Why do you need $100,000 then to put these out? You already have two almost complete games.
And it's not like it's unreasonable. They're asking basically $5 a game. If you get all three, it's $15 for the digital download of all three for the Gen 2 games. And then there's other ones where you can get the you can get a subscription to Retro, which I used to write for. I think I've written for issues 2 through 5 on that. I think I've written 3 or 4 on that. So, But you know what you can do? You can go out there. Did they sell? I actually saw at the swap meet. They have the little Intellivision 0-on-1s. I bet you those controllers work better than the original controllers.
They probably do.
And you get like 30, 40 games on it. So.
The thing is, like, I would actually play this version of Astro Smash.
Smash.
Looking at it, I was like, I don't think the power-ups are needed. But, I mean, I'd play it just because I like Astro Smash. I'd give it a shot, but...
So why not just put it on the App Store and see how many people buy it if it's already developed?
Exactly. You don't need a Kickstarter for this. Develop it if you already have the licensing, if you're working on the games. Maybe that's why you don't see Night Stalker stuff, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe they're still waiting for that one.
Right, but, you know, throw the Astro Smash out in the water and just see what it does. Business used to do.
Start with one and then work your way up to the other, see if there's interest.
I have no problem with Kickstarter. I just sometimes feel like these people are shooting for the moon.
This was announced a couple of days ago. This was... a new Mega Man series announced for 2017, which will coincide with the 30th anniversary of the game. You know what would have been cool for a 30th anniversary? A new game would have been cool. I knew at least one of the canceled Mega Man games would have been
Mega
cool.
Mega Man Legends 3, followed by a little
Universe
Zero
that
for
they
30th. Yeah, Universe would have been fun. Universe was looking good, too. This is kind of interesting, just because I've always thought that Mega Man would probably make a great sort of Monster of the Week cartoon or show, because you have all these really neat, different bad guys with crazy powers. You know, that would be fun to watch. I know there was a Mega Man animated series in the 90s, and I never saw it.
I saw a little bit. It was good. I thought the animation was great.
From what I heard, like, I think Vonnie said she didn't much care for it, but she did say it looked nice.
Yeah, it was anime style. It was fine.
So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I have a whole lot more to say about that, but, I mean, I would certainly give it a shot.
I just think it's strange that a company that cancels its Mega Man games and harbors very bad ill will from its fan base of Mega Man is now putting out a cartoon property with no game that's come out for, like, what's the last... By the time this comes out, 2017, what was the last Mega Man game? I guess Mega Man 10. What was that, like, 2012?
9.
11?
10. 2011. Because Mega Man 9 was 2009.
So we'll just say 6 years in between your last game that you're now doing a cartoon about. It's just really weird.
Well, Capcom's certainly not ashamed of, you know, money grubbing. I mean, you might think this is strange, but since that time they've also relaunched, it stopped. They relaunched the comic, too. And I mean, they've been putting out monthly issues of the Mega Man comics. So, I mean,
they're just licensing it. Probably they're just saying they're just getting paid for the rights. Okay, fine, do it. Just give us our money.
I actually think Udon is doing it, but yeah. So,
to them, it's not any risk. Okay, this company's going to pay us $100,000 to do the cartoon rights. All right, do it. You know,
and this isn't a risk to them either. That's what I'm getting at. It is weird what you say, but at this point, we shouldn't expect anything less from Capcom.
Do you think there's a chance of a Mega Man game for the 30th anniversary?
I don't know. I really don't. I don't know. I don't think so. And because of some of the things you said, like the ill will with some Mega Man fans, there are Mega Man fans who would be fine to get it, but there are a lot of Mega Man fans, I think, who would not care knowing that that a lot of the original creative people behind it are no longer with it.
Maybe we'll see. Maybe it'll be a Mighty No. 9 tie-in with the Mega Man cards, since that's the only Mega Man game we might see in the future. We'll see what happens. The original cartoon was interesting just because, from what I remember when I rewatched a couple of clips, Proto Man was like the right hand man of Dr. Wily in it, and they mixed it up with the Robot Masters. It wasn't just from like one or two games. They sort of mixed it up because that came out in the mid 90s, so it had like the first five or six Mega Mans to draw from for that one.
Yeah, depending. I mean, mid 90s would be at least the first six.
I think it had the NES games to draw from. And, it had Roll in it. It had Dr. Light. It had the dog and whatever.
Rush,
Rock, Roll. There you go. And actually, his name is Rock on the show. Even though they call him as Mega Man, his first name is Rock. So they actually
put that
in.
That's kind of cool, actually.
So everyone wins with the Mega Man. Go watch the 90s Mega Man cartoon. Go check it out if you haven't seen it. We don't talk about remakes too much, but I want to talk about this one. Because this was one of those VHS dubs that I beat to death. This was like... on this tape, it was these three movies. It was like Big Trouble Little China, Naked Gun, and The Major League. Very eclectic mix, but that's what we had in this VHS tape. And so I would watch Big Trouble Little China like weekly as a kid.
All recorded in what was the lowest quality? LP? It was LP, EP,
LP,
SP.
Yeah, LP was like 6 hours.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Was it? Or no, EP was 6 hours. LP was 4 hours.
And
EP
then SP was 2 hours.
SP was like the higher quality. And then once you got the 4 or 6 and that tape was winding slowly, it looked like crap. Either way, though, once you watch a VHS tape like more than like 12 times, it's going to start looking terrible anyway. So Big Trouble in China is obviously, it's one of those like cult movies that really... gained more and more notoriety once it got to the 90s and VHS, and once the DVD... That was one of the first DVDs I ever bought.
Right.
When I found out, wow, I was like, wow, there's a DVD coming out with, like, awesome menus and all these special features, and all the deleted scenes.
Remember
on there.
Remember when DVDs were new? I mean, even things like the menus were pretty,
like,
impressive.
It's only, like, 15 years ago.
I know.
I mean, I still remember... I worked in a Suncoast video store right when like it was still 90% VHS. We're talking like 99. It was like 90% VHS. And then you had like this little shelf like this. Like this was literally like the DVD section. It was like not even this.
No, Suncoast was directly responsible for me buying my DVD player in 99.
Yeah,
like, and it was the selection was this.
We're talking like 98 or 99 when there was literally only still like 150 DVDs at most.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't like the new movies coming out for VHS, not all of them were even on DVD. I remember like the Fight Club DVD being one of the first big ones that came out ever because there were so many special features. Or the Memento one.
Seven was a big one too.
Memento had this really, really difficult to figure out menu system that like you needed instructions to play the movie. It was insane. Like when you put the DVD, it's like how do I play this? You'd like go through another menu and hit this icon, hit the eye or something. It was like really weird. Anyway, I know we're getting way off topic here, but Big Trouble in Little China. I adore that movie. It's the action is fantastic. Kurt Russell is great. The actor who plays Wang Chi is fantastic. He's actually the hero. The little secret about Big Trouble in Little China is that Kurt Russell is actually the sidekick of the movie. He doesn't really do anything.
I've never actually seen the movie.
You've never... Jesus Christ. How did this become a topic? You've never seen the movie, but basically...
You wanted to talk about it.
Kurt Russell's the big John Wayne, says all the action sort of stuff, but actually he's kind of a buffoon.
Right.
And then the little sidekick, Wang, is the hero and saves the day and really gets the job done.
It's a movie that I've always wanted to see, but I keep waiting for it to be on Netflix, and it was for a while. And then I finally sat down to watch it one night, and it wasn't on Netflix anymore.
Was it on Netflix?
No. So I have to wait for it to be on Netflix again.
And once you see it, it has all the Asian actors you'd always see in other movies, like the bad guy in Lethal Weapon and also Die Hard. Like, he shows up. They got everyone involved.
But no Bolo, right? No Bolo Young?
No Bolo Young. He's not in the U.S. No Bolo Young. So they're remaking it with The Rock being cast, I guess, as Kurt Russell's Jack Burton character, who's the... Yeah, he drives the Pork Chop Express, the big rig. And I think The Rock could do well, but The Rock is too big and muscular and too brawny, I think. Like, Kurt Russell is not a small guy. He's probably, like, 6'2",
mm-hmm.
you know. But he's, like, The Rock looks like he can kill you. He's huge. Especially now. He's gotten so jacked, and now he's in his early 40s. He's gotten more jacked than ever before. And Kurt Russell never had that look about him. Kurt Russell had the look of a guy who thought he was tough that could take you on and might get a shot in or two. But Rock's a guy who can get a shot in and then break you in half. So it's really interesting that they're going that direction. And I wonder if they're not going to do a straight action remake instead of an action comedy, which would be totally a mistake if they went that route.
Oh, yeah.
But again, why remake a movie like this? Well, it's a cult movie. And Frank's rule about remakes is do it for a movie you couldn't do right the first time or a movie that did poorly. And Big Trouble in Little China did not do well at the box office when it came out. It was a John Carpenter film, if you didn't know.
Yes,
it was supposed to be the sequel to Buckaroo Banzai before they changed it and went to a different direction. So you never see it. You have to see it.
I'm a huge Carpenter fan, too, so I have to see it.
So apparently not.
Well, apparently not huge enough, but yes.
And it has Kim Cattrall at the height of her fame.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Kim Cattrall is the love interest. And she has green eyes, and the action's actually really good. Like, there's well-choreographed fight sequences with, like, you know, 50, 60 guys going at it once.
I have seen parts of it, like, when I've been at parties and stuff, and it's been on, but I've never sat down and watched the whole thing.
Speaking of martial arts,
we're going to talk about Kung Fury?
We're not going to talk about Too Many Cooks, but another viral, shortish film. 30 minutes is still technically short.
One that I like a lot better.
Kung Fury. This was kickstarted. It was a... I believe it was a Swedish film company that did this, directed by and written by David Sandberg, who also starred in it. And it takes place in Miami, 1985. And he's a martial artist, and he's trying to take out Hitler going back in time. And I cannot do it justice by the short synopsis.
No, there is no short synopsis.
You have to watch it. It's basically a homage to 80s action movies.
Which we just talked about. I mean, yeah, it's I mean, there's references to, I mean, little subtle things like the arcade machine, you know, kind of transforming like the RoboCop, whatever, the big one. Just the fact that, just the way he acts like around the women, the cars.
His voice, he talks like this, he's all gruff, he's all too serious.
The neon mixed with the grit is very much an aesthetic that
all
I
the
like.
Neon.
And that's so 80s, but the neon lights mixed with the gritty subculture. You've got all the guys walking around with the boom boxes, but they're toting Uzis as well. And it's not like they're protecting anything, they're just dudes walking around the city with boom boxes and Uzis.
It's very over the top. You know it's over the top within the first about about 20 seconds, a cop pulls up to three guys carrying, you know, automatic weapons and say, hey, you got a permit for those?
Yeah.
And he goes, I got your permit right here. And he flip kicks with his board the police car up in the air, and they shoot it and explode. You're like, okay, this is something way out there.
Right.
This is way over the top. So they get the sensibilities right for the first part. I mean, they even have the little introduction like Miami Vice,
mm-hmm.
after the prologue where he takes on the, spoilers, the robot arcade machine. And then they do, I lost it for the intro. I especially lost it when they did the segue. The second time they showed the dolphin on its flippers going backwards. Lost it. I don't know where they found this stock footage from, or if they just watched old Miami Vice episodes. They might have just pulled it from that,
right,
or something. But it was so, some of this was so on point that, like, it wasn't like trying to be 80s. It was 80s. It got it that on the mark. Especially the soundtrack is incredible.
Yes.
Like, the soundtrack is actually, like, it's not, it's actually really good.
Okay.
Besides being totally 80s, like synthesizers up the wazoo. It's almost totally synthesized.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, I mean, it's something I would listen to on my own. Oh, I forgot what I was going to say. Keep going.
So, yeah, you have, he's a cop who, he was struck by lightning and bitten by a king cobra. There's cool little things in the video, like the tracking goes off in and out.
So there's an action sequence, and it's obviously an action sequence that budget-wise they probably couldn't have done exactly how they wanted.
Or maybe that was the intent, though.
Maybe that was the intent, but whatever it was, I think to most people who are watching, they're going to think, oh, this is a clever way to get around budget constraints. So during, like, certain things, like the tracking goes out on it like it would on a VCR tape,
sure,
which is funny. What I was going to say is, when I started it, it just hits you so hard with so many 80s references.
Everything.
I felt like I was...
Converse shoes.
I honestly felt like I was going to get fatigued by it within the first 10 minutes. But as the movie went on, I just, you know, I don't... It was fun. I liked it. I don't know how many times I'd go back to watch it. I don't know that there's really anything more than the skin deep what you get. But it was fun to watch.
I think it was interesting that they could have went totally just, okay, this is straight 80s action, but they went over the top with stuff like, you have spoilers, Triceracop.
So
you think they're gonna stay, obviously it's over the top when you're fighting a robot arcade unit, so it's interesting they went in that direction where, we want to do 80s, but we'll take it so over the top that you wouldn't even see this in an 80s movie.
Well, but see, this is the thing to me. Okay, Triceracop was crazy and over the top, but all the other dinosaurs, do you remember how huge dinosaurs were in the 80s? Like, to me, that was just more part
were
of
they
the...
in a lot of movies though in the 80s?
I don't know if they were in a lot of movies, but I'm just talking like the rampant popularity of dinosaurs and stuff like that.
Even before Jurassic Park.
Yeah, even before Jurassic Park. I just felt like that was also kind of a nod to things that were huge back then.
This raised $630,000. I think the goal was, if it hit $1 million, it would have been feature length or something. Like, they would have went for like a 90-minute one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so, but they hit, I think originally, they hit a few of their goals. So there's a few anachronistic things that bothered me just from since I write, you know, so like the Power Glove is not mid-80s, obviously.
No.
And then there was a Viagra joke by the over-the-top cliche police chief yelling at Kung Fury. That Viagra in 85, they could have went in a different direction than that joke. Other than that, though, like I said, it was very entertaining.
The hacker was great. The
hacker man.
Yeah, hacker.
Did you recognize all the computers?
It was like
a VIC-20 or something was one of them.
There was a lot of shit.
Was there a Sinclair there?
There was a Sinclair.
Was it Sinclair?
Yes.
Yeah, just all the graph neon like grids.
I
of the
love
computer.
That part.
And that's
too.
Totally 80s.
Yes.
I think it goes back to Tron.
Mm-hmm.
So he was good. The gruff voice of Kung Fury was good. The green. This is shot mostly green screen. Probably like 95% green screen.
He even says, the director and the guy who stars as Kung Fury says, that the majority of the film is green screen.
So, great job. The other cool part about this, like I said, the soundtrack's amazing. I think some are actually songs that are out in the 80s, but whoever did the synthesized soundtrack, I gotta look it up. It was incredible. I was gonna say, if you watch this, it's actually, I think, better not to watch it in HD. This was shot in a way that they did something, I think, to soften it. To sort of soften the look, to sort of pull off that sort of even below standard definition 80s VHS. Go on YouTube, and if you watched it before, don't watch it in 780p. Watch it in 480 or even 360. It looks better because I think that's the way it was intended to look, like this was, you know, produced in the 80s and put on a VHS tape. So you have Thor showing up, not the Thor from Avengers, but, you know, the Thor, you know, God of Thunder, and you have Viking babes, and you have Hitler, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, don't take it too seriously. This guy is very talented. I want to see what he does next, if it's a sequel to this, or he does something else, you know. Good job. Great job. Any last words on Kung Fury?
I was trying to look up who did
the soundtrack.
The 7-inch. Yep, it is people. So the 7-inch record pressed on shiny red vinyl that's coming out includes the Hoff Spectacular tune as well as songs by Mitch Murder and Highway Superstar. So it's definitely people that I would have expected to do this soundtrack.
So they're all newer.
A lot of them are newer. Okay. Yeah.
Speaking of the Hoff, he does the closing credit song. And it's actually an outstanding song.
No, it's pretty damn good.
I know people get on Hasselhoff for singing. He actually has a pretty decent singing voice, if not good.
I loved that.
And
that
it's song. Called Survivor. And it's gotten, I think, more views than the it's got a million. It's got 13 million views at this point. And True Survivor. That's. And I want to put it on my iPod and rock it at the gym. I swear to God, the song is like, again, like with the soundtrack. The song doesn't sound like it was made to sound like the 80s. It sounds like an 80s song. I don't know what the producer did to pull it off, but it doesn't try too hard to sound 80s. It just sounds 80s.
I'm guessing
with the drum machines and the synths, you know, and Hasselhoff rocking it in front of a Lamborghini in the video.
I'm guessing it would probably be whoever produced it would probably be someone on the soundtrack, and Mitch Murder can hit that stuff pitch perfect. So,
well, go check out Kung Fury. It's this stuff, I'm glad that there's Kickstarter and YouTube for the stuff to come out, because obviously you wouldn't see this on TV or in a movie theater.
Dude, look at this. I mean, I totally need to own that. Look at the cover on that.
That is, wow. Yeah. That's like the painted 80s posters like The Last Dragon would do, or Big Trouble in China that I wish they came back with.
I am buying that.
You're going to buy that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be on my shelves.
Well, you know what you're not buying? A ticket to see Tron 3.
No, I'm not. Fuck off. Wow, that was the worst, meanest possible way you could segue in. So,
I'm not shocked at this, by the way.
No, I'm not shocked either. But, I mean, this is kind of what people think happened. So, Tron 3 is not happening. Sad.
The sequel came out already almost, it was 3.5 years ago it came out, right?
Yeah, but they did have people on board. They were still debating it. But what people think happened was that... I can't prove this, but it would make sense to me, because Disney is going to play things fucking safe. It's why it took them so long to come out with a Tron sequel in the first place. Although that kind of counteracts your argument. That doesn't mean there won't be another Tron sequel in 15 years, because, good lord, it took them 30 years.
By the way, it was
30 years.
It was 4.5 years ago. It came out December 2010. Okay. Holy shit.
So, Tomorrowland comes out, live-action movie that Disney wants to do. And apparently it flops horribly. Disney has always been kind of weird about live-action movies and doing them. They've always been very cautious around them. And I think a good portion of why they may have, even if it was only in the initial discussion phases, and no, it doesn't surprise me either, but I think they may have looked at what was going on with Tomorrowland and said, nope, not worth it.
Which is weird, just because Tomorrowland is based upon a part of Disney that not many people are aware of. Versus Tron.
That's kind of my problem with that reasoning, is that Tron is an established brand that at least people like. What do you think happens when... I mean, Pirates of the Caribbean was a one-time thing, guys. Haunted Mansion did not do well, okay? And basing a... I mean, people do know Tomorrowland. It's where Space Mountain and shit is, but basing it on a part of a park is not... You can't make a movie out of
that. But Pirates of the Caribbean was sold on Johnny Depp's great performance. Like, that was... When I went and saw... And I saw all three in the movie theater, even though I think I fell asleep during the third one, because it was so long.
I saw the first three in the theater,
Now they're doing the fifth one already. I didn't see the fourth one. But Johnny Depp's performance was iconic, I'd say, for that first one. It kind of falls apart as it goes on, but that was just a good movie. It had nothing... The good news is it had nothing to do with the ride so much that you can make any story you wanted to, which is why it worked. That's the way you can base a movie off a ride, is if you say, okay, well, we're just using the name and the general idea of them being pirates, and go off and do whatever you want.
Well, that's what they were trying to do with Tomorrowland. I think the problem was they promised something they couldn't deliver, which was, if you looked at all the concept art for it, it was gorgeous.
Well, I hate to say, but you have middle-aged George Clooney just... I don't want to see him in an action role. I don't think kids want to either. You know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know who that's appealing to at that point.
Well, there's a kid main character as well.
Yeah, but I mean, George Clooney is not known for doing these type of movies. He does usually these more independent, artsy stuff or stuff on his own. So it just wasn't a good fit. When I first heard about it, I was like surprised when I saw the trailer. Like, George Clooney's going to be in this genre flick? It just didn't fit. Because I don't remember George Clooney being in a genre flick for like 5 years at least. I can't even think of one that he's been in. You know what I mean? He does stuff like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? You know, that's usually what he does. Or Monuments Men. That doesn't make any money. Or that much. But this is why they were shaking.
Going back to Tron.
It only grossed $400 million worldwide, and the budget was $170 million.
Right.
So the good rule of thumb is that the production budget, you factor in at least half of that for marketing, at least. So we're talking $250, $300 million. And so for it to make that back, you got to do easily... you got to do easily 2 to 2.5 times your budget to make back the break even at the box office. They didn't do that. Now, obviously, they probably made their money back through merchandising. I think they had the cartoon around that time came out with
Uprising.
I think Elijah Wood voiced it or something, if I remember correctly. So it just seemed like probably too big of a risk for them to do. And plus, it's almost 5 years removed from the last. It would be more than 5 years before this movie comes out. That's a long time for a sequel. And I hate to say it, no Jeff Bridges, which would upset me.
No, that would upset me hugely.
So, like I said, I'm not shocked. If a sequel doesn't come within 3 years, I get kind of iffy. Like with the Matrix sequels, it's like, all right, let's take them. Now they're doing shoot it back to back. I think once you get too far removed, and it happened, you kind of lose that artistic sort of spark. And it happened a little bit with Back to the Future 2 and 3. Not that they're bad movies, but they were 4 years removed. It's like, well, get going. Start at least writing this stupid thing within a year or two, and let's get back on track. Now, I don't care if it takes a new director, but 5 years is a long time to wait between a sequel.
Well, a sequel that you're going to rely on the same actors reprising the same roles and looking roughly the same as they did.
Which they probably would. I mean, these aren't old people, but...
Well, no, but what I'm saying is, like, I mean, they were able to do a sequel to Tron 30 years after the fact because they were doing a whole generational switch with the story. As time goes on, that gets harder to do a direct sequel.
And honestly, I don't think Garrett Hedlund, I mean, he did fine it, but I don't see him carrying a movie by himself as like the lead in it. By the way, he was one of the finalists to be Captain America, I remember originally, and he was my personal choice at the time. Now, this guy looks like Captain America, he could have done it. But I said Chris Evans got the role, that's an aside. We won't be able to see Cillian Murphy as the villain. People always forget he had the cameo in the sequel.
Oh yeah, that's right.
He like took over the corporation. I think he was the son or whatever.
Yeah, God, that would have been good.
That would have been awesome.
I'm just pissed.
Now you're pissed at it, right?
Now I'm just pissed because I love Cillian Murphy.
Because he was the best part of that,
and I love Olivia Wilde. Olivia Wilde would probably be able to carry the movie better as a lead than Hedlund.
You think so?
Yes.
I don't think she's her box office for her movies hasn't been the best. I think overall, Cowboys and Aliens did terribly, and that movie was
because it was called fucking Cowboys and Aliens.
Well, that was
a good movie. I mean, I know it's based on a comic, but whatever.
So, sorry, no Tron for you.
Bah.
So this is our retro game topic du jour. This is something that was emailed to me by, we'll just call him Tom. And I guess he wanted to do an experiment. And I'll just read what he said. Pat, and that other guy, that's Ian. I've watched your YouTube channel for some time now, and I've always felt you exaggerate how, in quotes, resellers can drive up prices, which I always claim that if you buy more of a certain game, the price artificially goes up because people bidding it can't get it. It creates a psychology of the game being worth more than it is. That's what he's referring to. There are often tens of thousands of copies of almost all older games. That's exaggerating, but okay. So I did an experiment on eBay. With no intent of really making money, I put some thought into what game I was going to quote-unquote drive up the price. After some time, I committed to a game and started buying them up. This has been going on for over a year now, and I will say I was able to get the, quote, average price from around $3 to $4 to around $25, give or take. And we can confirm this via price charting. And the game he chose was Rampart for Game Boy. Not the Game Boy Color version, but the regular gray Rampart. So, to be honest, I'm spittle-shocked that in such a short time I was able to make such a difference. I don't own hundreds of copies. And I have not had to take a loan out to do this. With some effort and a few dollars, it would seem if you pick the right game, anyone can do this, which I always maintained. I've left buying/selling this game for a while, expecting it to go back down. But nonetheless, it seems to have found its new price of around $25. I was thinking selling off all the copies I have for $4 to $6 each to bring the price back down. What are your thoughts? Please don't use my real name. If you do, just say Tom. Thanks and keep the videos coming. I'm not shocked. And the reason this affects me is because... I bought Rampart during this time, and I I wasn't keeping close track, but it did take me a couple weeks to see this for me to get the game, because I didn't want to pay a buy it now. And I did remember losing an auction or two around, I want to say it was like summer of last year. It was when I think I bought it, because I had the Game Boy Color version, but I didn't realize there was a gray one. I wanted the original version. So I ended up getting it for like, I think, $8 or $9, something like that. But no, if you go look at price targeting, you go look on eBay, it'll say like the going rate right now for this game is $25. Why the hell is $25 the going rate for Rampart on Game Boy?
Especially if it started at 4 to 6. You know,
who wants the game? Right. No one does, except for one guy who created an artificial demand for it.
And what the thing is, he mentions...
By the way, he sent a picture confirming it was like 20 Game Boy Ramparts he had.
So, you know, Tom says that... He didn't think it was possible because there's tens of thousands of copies, even if that number is wrong. What it is if you have enough copies of a game and you have a stock of them and you put them on eBay is a kind of a narrow window. There's only so many copies of something up on eBay at any given time. So if you start charging incrementally more and more, it should not be very hard to get people to pay what you want them to pay for that game.
Plus, eBay will recommend you a price to put out for buy now. They didn't do that 5-6 years ago. Once they started doing that, you automatically, to eBay's benefit, because the higher games sell for, the more money they make, you set then higher and higher basement prices on buy it now.
Yeah, they have trending prices.
Trending prices, which means that's what they're selling at. So that's how, if that's trending at 25, I'll put it at 28. Or even higher. So if you go on price chart... this game was worth, in early 2013, according to price charts, the average, $3.30 loose in January.
Yeah, because it's a black and white version of Rampart.
Which is a game that no one wants. No one loves the game except for me and a few other people.
I like it, but I mean...
It rises a little bit, and then it really jumps up starting in the summer when I got mine.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes from March, $560. And then when I bought it, it goes up to about $799, July, $850. Then it shoots to $13. By October, it's at $18.90. Goes down slightly for November, $18. Shoots to $25 in December. So the game price increased, what percentage is that? 800% from January to December. It went up 800% from 3 to 25.
In a year.
Less than a year.
Yes, less.
And then it stayed at 25, at least on price chart, from December to June, which means that either one or two copies were... bought at the trending price, or no one's, or everyone's listed them at that high price, and no one's bought them. But it doesn't matter, because for trending for eBay, doesn't take account when a game doesn't sell. It only takes account the price it sold at. So these sellers that see this, trending price for $25, I'm not listing at $5, which is what it probably should be worth. They're going to keep it at $25 forever, for years maybe, and they're going to have it in the inventory. So the people that want it will have to then go to a convention, and someone will say, "Oh, it's going for $25 on eBay. I'll give you for $20." And that's how this happens. And I've gotten to arguments with people on forums and journalists about this stuff happens. I'm not saying this one case makes it all true, but it doesn't go against my argument.
Yeah, it definitely provides a fucking compelling argument.
A compelling argument, and these trending prices doesn't help. Obviously, all the buy it nows don't help. And websites like price charting don't help.
Yeah, no.
Because when price guides like Beckett came out for hockey cards and baseball cards, it created a bubble in terms of people looking at the price guide for everything, price guide, and never taking into account that they could sell for less than that, or that price may not be reflective of future sales or what they could get. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't make any sense.
No.
So I really hope that Tom, if that's his real name, figures out a way to reverse this process. He says he hasn't been able to see it reversed yet.
He says he hasn't done this yet. He said he stopped selling, hoping for it to go back down, which doesn't because of reasons that we've
stopped buying.
Well,
right now
I have left buying / selling. So he doesn't sell or buy them right now. So he's so for reasons we said, that's not going to bring the price back down. Now he's saying he will try to sell the remaining copies he has for $4 to $6 each to see if he can bring the price back down.
The only way to do that, if he does a Dutch auction and puts them all for once, but that doesn't mean that some asshole is not going to buy them all and then try to
flip them for $25.
Right now on eBay, one's at $22 from the Netherlands, where it says trending at $25.99, and then some other guy has it at $50. A game that I bought for $8 last summer, a game that used to average $3 a year and a half ago.
A game that we've always sold for $5.
Don't say that, they're going to buy it out. So, yeah, it's funny that Tom tried to prove me wrong by doing this.
And then
this year experiment said, "No, Pat, I think you were right."
It is pretty easy to do this.
And one sold for $22, one bought one at $40, thinking this game is rare when a guy is sitting on 20 of them. So there's not much you can do about it besides know if this exists and be careful when you look at these prices on Price Charge or the quote-unquote trending price and realize that it could be bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Ian!
So,
Nintendo's doing something that's kind of nifty.
It's okay, so Nintendo is doing something that's really unique for Nintendo, and I hope to see more of this. Nintendo is doing an indie bundle. Now, Humble Bundle is a website and a program, I guess you could call it, that's been going on for a number of years now. And it is... So what happens is they put a bunch of games up, and you get to pay what you want to get these games. And then they start getting an average price for these games. And then they post that average price, and they add a couple more games. And if you pay more than the average price, you'll get additional games. And then, you know, as the week goes on, they may add more and more and more. And, to people who had already paid above the average price, I believe they still get those games as well. This has been done a ton. It's been done... But it's mostly PC games, Steam, stuff like that. It's been largely PC games. I think companies like Sony and whatnot have tried to, cash in on this sort of idea by doing their frequent flash sales where they, drop games to 99 cents or, $5. But for Nintendo to do this is pretty huge because they've never really done anything like this. And if you have any experience within Nintendo's eShops, things are slow to go on sale. Things generally stay at the same price. And this Nintendo bundle is giving away an absolute insane...
What is it, like 10 games?
...number of games for basically...
they have Runner
10
2?
$10.
Runner 2 is a... That's a big one.
Guacamelee is big. Whoa Dave is fantastic and is gaining steam. It's a single screen arcade game. Mighty Switch Force is an old game that most people probably have, but it's actually the one way forward game I really like. It's got Stealth Inc., SteamWorld Dig, which received critical acclaim and is a lot of fun. The Fall, the first Ollie Ollie, which I was addicted to for a long time. The Moon Chronicles Episode 1, which is supposed to be a fantastic remake of the original DS game Moon. Sports Ball, Gunman Clive, which is excellent. And then Runner, which is going to cost you $15 alone if you don't buy it within the bundle.
So basically how this works, I've never done this before, is so the three main games, Guacamelee, Super Turbo Championship Edition, which is a great name, Woe Dave and Mighty Switch Force, you can get that for any amount.
So that, yes, you can pay any amount.
But if you do the average, which I guess they clock the average as it goes, at this point it's $9.21, you get the additional six games in the bottom, including Gunman Clive, Bit Trip, Runner 2.
And then the top corner is if you just pay $10 or more, period, you get all of this.
So that can incentivize people to say, oh, it's only 80 cents more, I get two more games, I can just do that.
And it's
Which is a great idea.
It's crazy because Runner and SteamWorld Dig alone are going to cost you well over $10.
I mean, I might do this. Is this Wii or 3DS or both?
It's both Wii and 3DS.
So they'll send you codes for both. Basically.
No, some of these games are only going to be 3DS. It says at the bottom, like Mighty Switch Force is only...
But I mean, it's one account, though, then they'll send me...
Oh, yeah.
Based upon my account, which is linked up, when I sign it to my 3DS, I'll have the 3DS ones and the Wii U will have the Wii U ones. Okay. That's a great deal. This isn't an advertisement for it, but, that's a fantastic deal.
It's a fantastic deal.
I should probably then mention that I might be in the process of being a Nintendo ambassador, just so that's on the table, but this is a great deal. I'm not being paid to promote this.
No,
this is fantastic.
It's a great deal, but what's more important to me is to see Nintendo try these new things. Nintendo would have never given away this many games before. These are independent games. So, these are not Nintendo games, but these are games on Nintendo's shop. Nintendo would have never done this.
So what happens here? Do they pay out a proportional amount to the publishers of these games, or how does this work?
I don't know how indie bundle works, but I know, for instance, like when PSN games go on sale, or you get them free with PS Plus, the developers still get money. So it's not like the developers of these games are going to go hungry because they're giving these things away for free. I think it's looked at as a way to generate. I'm sure someone knows the history and can correct me, but I think it's looked at as a way to generate.
Goodwill.
Yeah.
Which it is. I mean, it's $115 worth of games you get for $10.
Anyone who jumps into this anyone who does an indie bundle is doing it to generate goodwill and to get eyes on them. So, not only do these independent developers look good, because now you can get Guacamelee, a really good $15 game, for pennies, but it looks good for Nintendo because Nintendo's stepping outside their little box and trying something new.
So, and you can even choose how your payments going between the developers, charity, or the humble tip jar.
That's right.
So maybe Nintendo's not getting that much of this. So maybe
Nintendo's probably not getting any of this.
They're probably just, this is good promotion. This is great because I have no games on my 3DS, so I will do this. They've sold 67,000 almost. Wow, 67,000 bundles.
Actually, it's not like I have Ali Ali and Ali Ali 2 on everything except for 3DS, so I might do this as well. So I can get
cool.
It on my
3DS. We can play on the plane trip to too many games. We can play some multiplayer.
That's a single player, but
well, one of these has to be multiplayer. It's Guacamelee Super Trail Champion Edition. That's not...
That is multiplayer, but that is Wii only. Wii U only.
Oh, we'll bring the Wii
U. It's a Metroidvania.
All right, well, check this out. This is the Humble Nindie Bundle. It's time for Q&A on the CU podcast. This is from at Squirrel Whisperer.
That's a good name.
_chip_chip. This is two parts.
Chip, chip.
Sometimes, when I'm playing a game, I experience a sense of guilt for not doing something else with my time. Have you ever felt the same? Thoughts on the idea that playing games is a waste of time? That's kind of a metaphysical question.
It depends on how you look at it, too. It
depends on what is your objective for playing the game.
Yeah.
If it's like an escape, like watching a TV show, I mean, hell, I watched Daredevil in like 3 nights, 4 hours each. I could have played a game instead of doing that. And here's the thing. If you feel guilty about playing the game, you probably shouldn't be playing it.
Yeah.
Like, if you honestly should be doing something else, whether it's work, spending time with your family, if you put off going to like a public function instead of playing games, then, yeah, you shouldn't be playing it at that point.
I have to look at this in a smaller way. I'm not necessarily... I mean, that could have been what this person's asking, but, you know, waste of time can be... I mean, you can waste time any numbers of ways. If you have multiple hobbies, gaming can take up a lot of time, especially modern games. Japanese RPGs, the American RPGs, you know, even first-person competitive shooters with ink, third-person shooters.
With ink.
See, I never feel like when I'm playing a game it's a waste of time, because I try to budget my time properly. It's hard to do with work, but I try. When I feel guilty for playing a game, it's because I look at a stack of comic books. I look at my instruments. I look at things like that and I go, there are other things that I need to tackle. There's other ways that I could be spending my leisure time, and I'm constantly focusing on this. That opens up into an even bigger discussion about fucking consumerism and stuff like that. Like, do I need this much shit?
Yeah.
If I feel guilty for playing a game because I'm not reading the comic books that I have, or something, or listening to the records that I have, then that's a problem of acquisition.
You might also be asking about a waste of time versus doing something, I guess, healthier overall with your life than playing video games.
Sure.
In the general sense. And,
I mean,
that comes down to, I hate to say it, I mean, I'm playing games all less when I was a teenager or early 20s. That's just how I am when I get older. I'm doing more things that divide my time up equally. That's just how it is. You have to define what's important to you in your life. What is more valuable to you? Is it the entertainment of playing a video game versus something else? And that's what it comes down to. Just make sure you're playing the game for the right reason, not to sort of, you know, bury yourself into a hole and to avoid real life.
Yeah, I don't think any leisure activity is a waste of time as long as you're not letting your leisure activities overtake everything else. And that's what it really comes down to.
At Mr. Jared Roberts, is dumpster diving okay/ethical or just trashy? Ha, get it, trashy.
Funny.
I really don't have a problem with dumpster diving. If you're talking about in the back of GameStops when they throw out video game displays or cases for some reason, go for it. Have a ball.
If you're talking corporate dumpster diving, yeah. I mean, behind businesses, especially stuff where you can get something really useful, do it. As far as personal information, those businesses should be shredding all that stuff,
yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. Now, should you be rooting through people's trash cans? No. That is not good. But that is different than jumping behind, you know, a GameStop or a Target, I guess, to see what's back there. Now, would I ever do it? No, I'm a little squeamish on that whole notion. But
squeamish, you want to find a Kid Icarus manual in a dumpster somewhere?
Not next to a trout.
To a trout.
Or whatever.
There's a video game store and the sushi place.
Yeah.
Next to each other.
The fish bone comb. But yeah. Fishbone comb.
That's like some of my Tom and Jerry cartoon.
Well, I've been watching a lot of Tom and Jerry lately.
Who says, you know what, I've been watching a lot of Tom and Jerry lately. Like, that's a thing that...
I have.
How does that become a thing where, you know what, I'm going to randomly just watch a lot of Tom and Jerry?
Because I get home from work at about 8:45. I sit down. I flip on my TV. I go to do something, and I go, oh, we still have Boomerang on the TV, and oh, Tom and Jerry is playing from 9 to 10. Tom and Jerry is my favorite fucking cartoon.
At least watch the first few years before they became friends, when they're just diabolical and really violent.
Early Chuck Jones and
the '50s and sixties. Yeah, early sixties
was great. I mean, there are definitely shit eras in Tom and Jerry, but the good eras of Tom and Jerry, best cartoon ever.
How can they be friends? They hate each other.
There's a very complex relationship between Tom and Jerry. No, it is.
Sure, sure. Okay.
It is.
Write a term paper on it. Jesus fucking Christ.
Shut up.
I've been watching a lot of Tom and Jerry recently.
Oh, I haven't. David. There's questions from David. Dave Van Dam Net.
That's a great name.
I like that.
Van Dam Net.
Steam is now offering refunds. Could this cause publishers to stop pushing buggy stuff out since they could lose money?
Is there like a certain time period to return the game? Like you have like 10 days or 30 days to return a digital download?
I'm not sure. But since a lot of these require you to be, I believe, logged into Steam, I think that's how it works.
Oh, yeah.
Then,
if you're
logged into play. They can tell if it's deleted or not. I think it's a great idea, actually. And it's one that I think some places have... It's been needed for quite some time because of exactly what he says. When there is no recourse for these people putting out unfinished games, because you can't just go back to GameStop and return a new game for your money back. They won't do that. This way, especially through Steam, if you buy a game and it sucks, like, say, Assassin's Creed, you can be like, no, don't want it. Sure. And yes, it really will... I think it will put us... a clamp on these developers and be like, no, you got to start putting out shit that's playable because otherwise I'm going to return it within a week and I'll wait till 6 months down the line when it's basically free and I'll buy it after it's patched.
If you could have done that with the last Assassin's Creed and say 30% said, fuck this, I'm returning this, that would have put a huge dent in Ubisoft's business. They would have probably changed my mind. Oh, maybe we can wait to put these out instead of forcing them out.
Just imagine if this was in place when SimCity came out, the most recent SimCity.
What is it, 6 or whatever it was? Or?
They didn't give it a number, but I mean, I do know that they did allow for some refunds, I believe, but they made it a hassle. But that game was so universally trashed and loathed because of its problems.
Sure.
They would have eaten shit on that if people were allowed to return it.
Has there been a SimCity since that? That was already, 3 years ago it came out?
There hasn't. I mean, everyone says just play SimCity 4.
This is at Banana Bread. I love that. Banana Bread.
We've got a lot of good names
That's
today.
A good game.
Hey, Banana
good
Bread.
Names. Thoughts on games being expensive because they're good versus being rare? Obviously, we're talking about retro games. I think it's interesting that games can get expensive because they're just really popular and good and common, like a Contra, a Super Mario 3. Everyone wants them because they're excellent games. That's fine. We're talking like the higher echelon of games. Usually, most of the time, we're not talking like the games that are thousands of dollars. We're talking the games that are worth hundreds. Usually, they are games that are good. You know, the ones on Sega CD, Sega Saturn working design games, Snatcher, games that are not just hard to find, they're actually good. Because there are games that are hard to find in those systems that aren't worth nearly as much.
I'd say there's about an equal amount. But
you think so?
Yes. I would say, depending on the system you're collecting for, there's an equal amount of crap to good that is just as expensive.
Okay, I think it depends on the system then. Once you get over like $500, just say, you get to that weird point though where the game doesn't matter at all in terms of how fun it is; it's just in how rare it is.
Right.
It gets to that weird point where Magical Chase, it's a great game. Would it be worth thousands if it wasn't as fun? Probably. It probably still got pumped up.
Yeah, it would have been pumped up eventually. My take on this question is like, I think I'm talking lower echelon here. Games that are rare are obviously rare. They're going to be expensive. But games being expensive because they're good, I tend to think that this is kind of like some of the flack that I get in store when someone's like, oh, I can't believe X game is blah, blah, blah. Why is that? Well, because collecting has become a popular hobby, and there are games that are good that everyone wants. And if people buy up all those games that everyone wants because they're fun and they're popular, there are going to be less of those for people to buy. The perfect example is Contra, which used to be like a $10 game and is now a $30 game, and that's just what it is.
But those aren't being bought by collectors mostly. Those are being bought to play. That's what
I'm not talking collecting. I'm just talking people...
Game collecting.
No, people get into collecting, buying...
The reason Super Mario 3 is a $15 game and not a $3 game is because of people are buying it to play it.
Yes. Well, that's... Yes, I'm just using the term collecting wrong.
Super Mario 3, there was just as many of those as RBI Baseball and Silent Service and Bases Loaded. It's just that people will keep those and not throw them back out.
Yeah. There's a reason why I have, like, at one point in time, we had, like, 42 silent services between the two stores.
Who bought that when we were kids? I guess, like, 40-year-old guys that loved the simulators.
Everyone fucking had it, too. Like, I can't think of many friends' collections where that wasn't in there somewhere. It must have come out, bombed. Or something. And
well, they didn't bomb. They sold a ton of them.
Well, no, what I'm guessing is they produced a shitload of them, and they sat there until they ended up in bargain bins, and people snatched them out of bargain bins.
You think that's what it was? They were like $10 games at Toys R Us?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most common games.
Oh, yeah. Silent Service. Definitely. Easily.
But that's what it comes down to, is that I think it's fine. I have no problem with a game being expensive if it's sought after, like a Contra. That to me is the true supply and demand, when everyone wants to buy it to play it. Like you said, you get a Contra traded and it won't stay in the store for more than a day.
No, it won't. I'll give someone 20 in credit for it. It's not. It's going to be gone in a day at 30 to 35.
Okay, this is from that Final Stage show. What do you think is going to happen with Kevin Owens now after beating John Cena at Elimination Chamber? Wrestling talk.
So that was huge.
Were you shocked? Jim Ross predicted it.
I went in thinking that Owens was going to win. Here's my problem. It was a good match because of the Owens victory, and there were some great spots, all basically on Owens. When Cena came out of the pop-up powerbomb the first time, I was uncertain. It was long. It felt like a very long match, and basically, for Owens to beat Cena...
First match in WWE.
Cena kicked out of every single thing Owens threw at him.
Well, you expect that.
Yeah, but, I mean, dude, you really have to see the match. Like, it's just, it's exhausting.
I heard it was a great match. It was like a 4-star match.
It was a good match. 4-star maybe, 3.5, 4-star. It's good because Owen wins and there was a lot of good spots. It's good to see younger talent coming in and in their first WWE match, watching them have enough faith in them to go over Cena.
I think it was I hate to say it, is a bad decision. If you're going to do that, you should have done it with Bray Wyatt last year, a guy that was around for 6-7 months. To do it with a guy in his first match, I hate to say it, a lot of these people, some are watching NXT, but the casual people watching on TV aren't. They're like, who's this guy? He shows up on Raw twice, has a match, and beats the face of the company.
You know why? It's because Elimination Chamber was a network-only pay-per-view. The people who have the network are watching NXT.
All right. I just think it's weird that they don't have Rusev win. I wanted Rusev to win at WrestleMania. I thought it would have been great if Rusev won.
I would have liked that, too.
And then, yeah, Bray Wyatt. Now, Bray Wyatt's now a joke, almost. I don't think he even has a feud going on.
He doesn't.
You think he lost to Ryback. I haven't watched in a while, but it's weird to do that with the guy who's a champion of NXT, because that means you're going to now bring him up to the main roster and have him drop the belt. Are you going to combine it? It's just a weird move. I'm not saying it's obviously good to give him the rub, but that rub could have been given to someone else. And it's not like Cena's going to job again anytime soon to someone cleanly like that. You know, it's not going to be like he's lost cleanly to me. He's lost cleanly to maybe 5 or 6 guys in 15 years.
Well, the other thing is you know, I think they're looking at a lack of credible heels, and
it makes them credible, obviously.
They're looking at a lack of credible heels, and here's a guy that they had demolished Sami Zayn twice. Who's a fan favorite and arguably just as good of a wrestler as Kevin Owens. And they have him come up and they have him destroy Cena. They are building this guy to be the next monster because they need one.
But that could have been Bray Wyatt.
It should have been.
Rusev was being built for a year to be that. He was undefeated. You know,
Rusev could have continued to be that way, but Rusev is injured now.
And now he's injured.
Bray Wyatt, I will agree, I liked Bray Wyatt. They never gave Bray Wyatt a good program. They never gave him a good program.
Well, they did, but he never beat Cena. He never beat the guys he went up against, except for, like, Jericho. It was the only guy he beat, really.
Yeah. But I'm happy, I guess,
because first of all, people would say, oh, you can't have monster heels. Sure, you can have monster heels. You can book them, right?
Wow.
You
can, Kevin Owens is a monster heel. The first one I've seen in forever.
You can have guys like that. You can have guys like Lesnar that destroy people.
And I'm sorry, I think Owens makes a more convincing heel than Lesnar does.
I don't, but okay.
He's better on the mic.
Yeah, but he Lesnar is a monster looking. Owens doesn't look like that guy. He doesn't look like the typical wrestler. He has a beer belly. You know, he doesn't have the chiseled abs. I'm not saying he can't wrestle, but he doesn't look like that. But people are already talking about building to, like, I hate to say, they're already saying, what if Owens is this big heel and Lesnar comes back as a face eventually? That could be like a huge match, or that'd be amazing. You know, but having a monster heel around, especially regularly, which Lesnar wasn't, gives you a lot more options. And plus, it gives you a lot more unpredictability about, oh, maybe he will beat this guy cleanly. And not just, you know what I mean? Like, maybe he will tear through people.
That's one of the things I liked was when he won, and my buddy and I looked at each other, we were like, wow, so what can't happen now?
Sure.
You know, when an NXT guy's first match on a WWE show is a victory over Cena clean.
No, I mean, maybe that shows that Cena, well, Lesnar destroyed him on a pay-per-view. That was a big deal last year at SummerSlam.
Well,
so
it was funny because my friend and I were talking. We're like, we're getting ready for the match to end, and we're at this point, like I said, I went in thinking that they were going to let Owens win, and then halfway through, I'm like, they're not going to let Owens win. And my buddy goes, he's at the goddamn age where he needs to be putting over the new talent. And then 3 minutes later, he did. So if Cena wants to keep doing that, I'll have more respect for Cena.
At Geodude, thoughts on new gen NES, in quotes, hard games like Dark Souls, Bloodborne, Lords of the Fallen?
So my personal thoughts on these, so Dark Souls and, you know, Demon Souls, Dark Souls 1 and 2, Bloodborne, all roughly part of the same series. These games, for people who haven't played them, although they're really popular now, I feel like people would know them. They're extremely hard action games. Checkpoints are few and far between. You're always left with very minimal supplies of what you need. And they definitely appeal to people who want to kind of memorize patterns, remember where enemies are, where things are happening. You don't need memorization, especially in one like Bloodborne, which I hear has very good battle mechanics. But these do feel a lot like, say, Mega Man games, just for
they don't
example.
Hold your hand.
They absolutely 100% do not hold your hand. You will get fucking lost really quickly. It's going to happen. That's part of the game, and that's part of what people enjoy. For me, I'm kind of at the point where that sort of thing doesn't really appeal to me, but I'm glad that there are games out there that don't hold people's hands. Especially with how well Bloodborne is supposed to be in terms of improvements over the previous Dark Souls games. You've now got these games that, unlike, you know, just say any X, Y, or Z first-person shooter that gives you 15 checkpoints in a level, you have to work for your progress in these games. But are they going to be for everyone? No, absolutely not.
Not much to add. I really don't. I haven't played any of those. At Cerebus92, it's my own fault. It's my own fault. But how much responsibility should sellers have to educate novice or new retro collectors?
The part that you left out was he goes on to say, I bought a Mario paint and
didn't realize I needed
the mouse.
This goes back to what I said about being good resellers versus bad. A bad reseller may not tell them because they don't give a shit, or may not know that these things happen in these games, or these accessories are required in these games.
I can only say so. I mean, my examples, there's tons, but the ones that are most common are, it's up to, if you should have some idea of what you're doing, but a good reseller can smell the customer that is getting back into it or might not know and is going to tell someone about these things. For instance, we do not even sell Mario Paint without the mouse. That's just, you can't fucking buy Mario Paint from us unless we have the mouse with it. If someone wants to buy a Zapper, which happens every day I go, do you know that will not work on an HDTV? And every day they put it back, and I don't make $5. Whenever someone wants to buy Perfect Dark or Donkey Kong 64 or Majora's Mask, I make sure that they have the expansion pack. Explain to them what it is. If they don't know what it is, I show them where it is and one that has one. Then they go, oh, yes or no, and then they don't buy it. I think for some scummy resellers, you know, they just want to make the buck. It's not up to them. But to me, And yes, it's because I like to be ethical and good in my business, but I'm not going to lie. Part of it is pure anxiety. I don't need people coming back to me pissed off. I want everyone to have all the info they need right there so that when I make a sale, I know that they are leaving with what they want and they know what they need to do with it.
Yeah, it just comes down to being a good seller and treating your customers correctly.
Yeah.
You are there to... When you work... I don't care if you have a booth at a flea market or a table at a convention. You are there as a seller, as at least in some small way, an authority on what, in theory, you're selling. Again, going back to battery sellers are not an authority. They just want a quick buck and don't know what the hell they're doing.
Or they could be an authority, but they don't give a shit. They might know all
worse.
The...
Yeah, well, it's actually worse.
Which I think is actually more often the case. I think that is, just from some of the stuff I've seen around here, that's more it. They just need to move the stock. They don't care.
They don't give a shit.
They don't give a shit. If you ask for a Zapper, they're going to sell you a Zapper. If you need a Gun Con, they're going to sell you a Gun Con. They don't give a fuck if they know that by now you're probably working with an HDTV. They're going to sell it and not warn you. I honestly can't do that. It creates too much anxiety in me.
You don't want... Has that ever happened? Have you ever screwed up and someone came back?
Yeah, I did once because someone was buying a bunch of, like, Nintendo games and they seemed like they knew, you know, they knew their stuff. And, you know, it's happened a couple of times. They've always been cool about it. But, like, you know, when you're buying 10 Nintendo games from me and you're like, throw a Zapper on or something like that, and they call me up, the Zapper's broken. It is. I'm sorry. I'll replace it. Come on back. And then as I'm giving him the other Zapper, I go, shit. Do you have an HDTV? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that won't work. Oh, can I exchange these light gun games? Yes, you can. So, I mean, that's the end of it. But yeah, it does. I slip from time to time, but it's never in a malicious way.
You sure?
Yes.
At regular Nintendo, Alan. Hey, Alan. On eBay, does the term, in quotes, untested pretty much mean a misleading way to say broken? LOL.
I have a rule of thumb for this. Real quick.
What's your rule of thumb?
Look at what the seller is selling, and if they're selling a bunch of shit that's untested, they probably have a lot of stuff, and it's probably just literally untested. If it's one person selling a Virtual Boy, and it says untested, yeah, and they're not selling anything else, it's probably broken.
If they have all the ways to hook up a system, and it says untested, be wary, and then email them and say, listen, is this power on? To get the signal, because there are people that will be honest and, hey, I'm selling this system for parts.
Yeah.
You know, I have a Bally Astrocade right now that powers on but doesn't get any game. So if I sell it, I will say that. It's tested. It doesn't work. Maybe you can fix it. I don't know.
Right.
But here you go. But to say untested for a system is weird. Versus a cart game, I feel a little safer because 99% of cartridges you can clean and get to work. You know, so that's not a big deal to me versus a disc game where if it's scratched, you know, you might have to do something more.
Yeah, I remember there was a time when I think we were moving to the new location on Newport, where we had just put all sorts of systems that either needed cords, were dirty, or they needed to be cleaned. And, you know, they got mixed in with some broken ones, and basically it was just like, well, what the fuck do we do with this? We're unpacking a new store, do we have time? And it was just, set it aside, and it really was. It was just a pile of, like, 30 untested systems. Like, literally just not tested, and they all went for, like, $5. Like, it's not always that it's a broken system. But, you know, there's, for all we know, that could have all been working shit. You know, because we do tend to keep very good track of our broken stuff. But
sometimes just a way to just say, oh, it's untested, I don't know. Just,
yeah, I mean, a person clearing out a storage unit finds, you know, 8, you know, Genesis systems and just doesn't give a fuck. Yeah, they're throwing it up there and saying untested, and for all you know, it works fine.
Overall, do your homework. Know, this for more for systems, know which systems are more likely to last the test of time.
Cartridge-based
systems.
Yeah.
You know, even old Atari systems should work. For the most part,
the power cord is what goes most frequently on Atari systems.
Know that disc-based systems, untested, yeah, now you're getting into weird territory.
GameCube, maybe, nothing else.
Yeah. From at Nielsen Anton, chiptune and sprite art were born from limitations. How do you think limitations have benefited games in the long run? It's like any art form. When you're forced to think in creative ways to do something that you can't have the freedom to do, it just forces you to come up with cool ideas. And cool workarounds and yeah, I think that not having limitations is bad, especially in film, more so than games, because if you can just CG anything you want, maybe you shouldn't be CGing anything you want. Maybe you should be writing a better story or a better plot device or a better character arc to take the place of, you know, as Frank would say, like car chase and explosion every 5 minutes. I guess the same thing can be said for a video game.
Yeah, you know? I mean, Atari, like Pitfall, something like Pitfall would never have been dreamed to have been able to be done on an Atari.
They figured it out.
But they figured it out. You know, someone studied it long enough and figured out how to work around these limitations and did it. In music, you know, people always, you know, people who acquire a ton of, like, you know, bass guitars or synthesizers or whatever, you know, it behooves you to sit down sometimes with one piece of gear or one thing and just work with it and figure out how you can get it to do something close to what you want. And the same goes for video games and the limitations of the system.
Yeah, I mean, think about games that were single screen, and then someone had to think of, well, what if we get that screen to scroll when we walk over? It's like, what? How do we do that? Let's figure it out. Let's do it. So it always takes that person to think about what's the next sort of frontier we could go towards. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have those, or if you have it too easy, maybe you get lazy, or maybe you just, you know, you think, we'll just do what we did the last 50,000 times, you know. We'll do like...
Mario Brothers, we can scroll to the right. Can we scroll to the left? No. Maybe for the next one? No, that's impossible.
No.
We're going to do it.
Only Super Mario World. we'll save it for that. At Dave Van Dam Net again. Are there any games you regret not being able to beat? I always regret not being able to beat Ninja Gaiden as a kid because I used to rent that freaking sucker almost every other month and would always get up to the last level and then just fall short and not destroy my eyesight probably because of that. It was just one of those things where it's like, I want to beat Ninja Gaiden. And then I could never beat Mike Tyson's punch out as a kid. Could never do it. Get up to Mike Tyson without using the code. We'll get destroyed. Maybe get to the second round every now and then. But now... I beat him during the marathon after not having sleep for a day. I don't know what the hell... How do I get better at these games when I got older? I don't even know.
Yeah, I think...
It's weird.
I think Mike Tyson's Punch-Out is one that I think if you were growing up in the 80s and had a Nintendo, that's one that... I'm not saying for everyone. There's a lot of genius gamers out there. But for a lot of us, like, plebeians like me, I couldn't fucking do it. I mean, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out...
I couldn't either.
I think Mike Tyson's Punch-Out... is going to be, was at least, one of those...
benchmarks for, like,
being
a good game player?
Being a good game player. And I think it's one that a lot of people left their childhood still carrying behind them, not having ever beaten. As far as modern-day stuff, you know, a lot of stuff on my Xbox 360, because it was built like shit and broke down, so I have a pile of games that's useless. I think that's a pretty different topic, but, you know...
I couldn't beat Modern Warfare 2 through all the checkpoints every 5 seconds.
No, I mean, there are some, an honest answer, there's a lot of RPGs that I have not beaten that I would love to beat, and seriously, it's simply a matter of time. I just don't have it.
Trying to think of any other ones that I couldn't really beat. Oh, I could never beat, Well, I got a cheap book, though, for, I always bring it up, Return to Zork was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I would never have bought it if it didn't come packaged with my Sandblaster 16 CD-ROM drive. So, I always regretted not being able to be smart enough to beat that without the guidebook, but there's no way even today I probably would be able to do it.
So, okay, it's funny that you brought that up, because I used to play a shitload of adventure games, and I could beat most of them. One of my favorites, though, that I never beat, and I still regret not beating it, is The Adventures of Willy Beamish by Dynamics.
There you go. Yep. That's a tough one,
too. I couldn't do it, and then I later on found it. Now, I could probably find a properly clocked version right now, but Willy Beamish had a... it was an adventure game, but there was timed stuff, too.
You had a few days to get to the contest or whatever.
And there
the
was...
frog.
There, on the last day, there's a very difficult part where you have to rescue your frog from being made into frog soup. And there's timing on it, and the clocking is fucked up when you played it on later computers.
Oh, really?
And it was literally impossible to do. And I just banged my head constantly against it until I realized, I'm walking faster, everything's happening faster, I can't do this. Because I breezed through the first 2 days of the game, like, no problem.
Can you buy that online on Steam? Or
I'd have to check GOG and see. Because GOG would give it to you in a format that
they give you with the DOSBox already. Yeah. Or you can try to do it yourself with DOSBox if you have the CD-ROM stuff.
Right, but like I said, if it was available on GOG, they would have DOSBox made.
It's on Sega CD.
It is.
Don't have someone go buy up all the copies and drive up the price. And email me a year later. It could happen.
I think the last copy we had was like $15.
I should have bought it. I don't want to buy it.
I always want to buy it when I see it, but I have no Sega CD.
My mind's getting fixed. Well, that does it for the See You podcast. Ian's giving me a weird look. We're going to be at Too Many Games.
We are. There's going to be too many games there.
If you go to Too Many Games, use this code I'm going to give you to help me and Ian out, show your support. This probably won't work. I'll probably put http://toomanygames.com/ I'm sort of pausing and delaying for time. We have a Patreon, patreon.com/pixelsickle.
We do.
And with that, you'll be able to see the entire podcast in its entirety twice a month, or could be three times a month sometimes. So we appreciate your support there. So yeah, if you want to go Too Many Games, you don't have a ticket, that's June 26th, 28th in Oaks, Pennsylvania. Go to toomanygames.com/gamer/NESpunk and then purchase your ticket that way and show your support for the NES Punk.
We'll have a grand old time.
And the other guy, Ian. So with that gone out of the way, without further ado, we're going to see you in 2 weeks. It'll be our, wow, E3 will still be going on. So we'll have our like E3 update on the 17th. That'll be exciting. We never really did that before, like the hot news, and I think Nintendo will have their conference by then.
I'm predicting Animal Crossing.
I'm predicting maybe a surprise. So we'll see you later. Bye.
Bye-bye.